Hi there. I'm Tamson Granger.
I'm Dan Apuha.
It's March 26, 2017, and here we go with Dan and Tamson read the paper. So what do we got today?
Well, we're going to start with the show The New Yorkers. We mentioned last week we're going to see that Encores production, and the Encores production was a hit. I'll just read you a line from the New York Times Review. So this is what Manhattan looked like in the tipsy yesterday of Prohibition. Imbibe freely all you kombucha swilling health nuts of the 21st century of the cocktail being served at City Center with a delirious Encores concert production of Cole Porter's The New Yorkers runs through Sunday.
So we were skeptical.
We were very skeptical.
We had really no expectations. The minute we heard it was a Jimmy Durante show,
Right. It's old-fashioned. We were not familiar with it. It goes back to 1930. And it's kind of a bizarre thing. It's and we only learned about it in connection with this production. It's a show that was put together in 1930 as a cross-selling maneuver on the part of New Yorker magazine. And it was spearheaded in part by Peter Arno, the famous cartoonist for New Yorker magazine. And it is in some ways a bunch of musical set pieces designed around cartoon-like situations. Is that fair enough, Thompson?
Yeah.
I mean, just to set the stage for Peter Arno, and I know people are familiar with the New Yorker cartoons, Peter Arno was a stalwart, and as the program describes it, Arno's early targets consisted largely of wealthy older men chasing after chorus girls, stout dowagers whose sex appeal had spectacularly failed them, clueless little bald men with waxed mustaches, alcoholic blue bloods, the bootleggers who serviced them, and working-class stiffs who watched it all in fascinated horror.
Well, yeah, this pretty much summed up the show.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was a crazy...
But, I mean, no matter what,
yeah,
it was just a delight.
It was a delight. And it was...
And no big names.
No big names.
You weren't saying... It just somehow worked.
It
was fun to watch.
They said the heck with it. They did a show that was so entirely dated and politically incorrect and sexist and anything else you can think of. And two out of every three gags worked, which means one out of every three gags didn't work. And you mentioned Jimmy Durante. They had a Jimmy Durante character, and that was not very good.
But you just sort of cut him a break.
You cut him a break. You said, look,
after a while, you got kind of used to him. You said, oh, okay, here comes this.
And, you didn't know whether you would fool the performer. Probably not, because the material is just so awfully dated. So it's real hit and miss. But there are a lot of hits, and there are a lot of wonderful songs, wonderful laughs, and wonderful lyrics. And one of the things that goes on in a show like this that makes it swim rather than sink is Cole Porter. I mean, you can put together a bunch of gags and old-time vaudeville, but here the score is written by Cole Porter. And Cole Porter was, I think most people probably know, one of the great songwriters of the 20th century. You know, if he's not number one, he's in the top five. And his biggest show was not this one, it's Kiss Me, Kate. But he wrote song after song after song. And to give you an idea, the story is, to the extent there is a story, is that you have a group of people who are really New Yorkers, believe it or not. And sure enough, guy and gal meet. And when they meet, this is what the guy says. Now, this is, I should say, when Cole Porter wrote a song, he wrote a verse that starts before the song that is recited, as many songwriters then did. And so that's some of his best stuff. So here's what this verse says. The moment that you appear, your fetching physique is hardly unique. You're mentally not so hot. You'll never win laurels because you're morals. But I'll tell you what you've got. And the song goes on to say, you've got that thing. And it's a great song. Well, at a certain point, they decide that Manhattan is not all it's cracked up to be. So the song becomes, let's fly away. Let's fly away and find a land that's warm and tropic, where Roosevelt is not the topic, all the live long day. Let's not delay. Make Mother Nature our Messiah. New York is not for us. Let's fly away. I mean, these are pretty good lyrics. And then, of course, naturally, they added back to Manhattan. Take me back to Manhattan. The more I travel across the gravel, the more I sail the sea, the more I feel convinced to the fact New York's the town for me. You know, it's Cole Porter. And there is one classic song, which is Love for Sale.
Yeah.
Which is a song, believe it or not, about prostitution, and it's a serious song, which you wouldn't think belongs in the show, but in the old-fashioned way, had a wonderful singer come out and sing this serious song. brings the house down.
She was wonderful. Do you know her name?
No. I don't.
Where's the program? We had the program.
Well, look it up. But she's fantastic. And it's the song that's remembered. Her name is Cyril Aimé. She's a jazz singer.
M.A.,
sorry. And yet, even all these lesser Porter songs are enough to make it a wonderful evening. But bad news. Only
it's over.
Through Sunday. We warned you last week. Next time, look up Encores.
Well, we didn't know. So, you passed on a food article to me.
I did.
And it doesn't seem more up your alley than my alley. Because it's about
because it
food
sense,
and,
right.
and big data. Big. It's, you know, it's food from athletes.
Right, food from
basically.
Athletes. That's what the article was called, food from athletes.
Know, back to this idea. This is in the Wall Street Journal. And so back to the idea of using math to figure out what tastes good. And they talked about a Dr. Michael Nestrud, who uses graph theory to kind of divine what are harmonious pairings
That's right.
of food combinations.
Better food through science.
Okay. And, yeah, so that's okay. Then they talked about another guy, Heston Blumenthal, who came up with an unbelievable combination, this fabulous combination of white chocolate and caviar.
Right.
Which was unexpected and a little weird, but ridiculously delicious. And they managed to analyze it and figure out that it was because of shared flavor molecules.
Right.
In this case, trimethylamine of these two foods, these molecules, because they both have these molecules, they taste good together.
Right.
And so then you begin to say, well, what other foods sharing molecules can we put together? And they come up with things like snails and beets.
Right.
Apparently another great combination.
I don't see what the problem is. This seems entirely persuasive to me.
Because I just think there's more to food than that. I don't think it's about scientific combinations.
Right.
Okay. I think, and besides, I'm not interested in trying to develop some sort of iconic, you know, standalone perfect flavor. Because I'm more interested in, you know, the mood, the meal, the whole package. Okay. And there's so much that's spontaneous and subjective that I think affects how things taste, not just the molecules.
Molecules are in there. Okay.
But, you know, sometimes when you have a great meal or a great dish and then you go back and try to recreate it, or you go back to the restaurant again and order it, or you go back to the liquor store and get that bottle of wine, and it just doesn't taste the same. That's because of all those, you know, the circumstances, the context affects the flavor. For instance, we were in New York last night.
Yeah.
And we met your nephew, Sean, and his girlfriend for a drink. We had a delightful time. We were at the Breslin, and we ended up deciding to stay for dinner.
Right.
And we had a very nice dinner. Okay. And then we struck up a conversation with the people next to us, who turned out to be
wine importers
and distributors.
Which is kind of a little lost on us. We're not
right, because we're not connoisseurs.
But they were connoisseurs. They knew the wine. They ordered a very expensive bottle of wine, apparently. The restaurant was excited about that. But they were delightful guys, and they offered us some of their wine.
They shared the wine.
Probably the best wine we ever had.
But why was it so great?
The molecules.
I don't think it was the molecules. I think it was we had a great meal.
Yeah.
These people were absolutely delightful, including the guy I was sitting next to, Diego Faccione.
Right.
And I think the whole mix is what makes something taste delicious.
Fine. I mean, I don't disagree with you, but, you know, every once in a while you need a little white chocolate and truffles. But I get your point.
It wasn't truffles, it was caviar.
Oh, okay.
But I gotta admit, fish is like the secret ingredient in a lot of things. The Romans had a fish sauce they put on everything. It was kind of a rotten fish sauce, but apparently made everything taste good. But back to New York, We have a museum.
Metropolitan Museum.
We have a Metropolitan Museum update talking a little bit about the interim head, Daniel Weiss, and his sweeping plans to balance the budget, etc. So we know a little bit more about this guy. Remember we had that whole discussion with the Gopperts about what this kind of person would have to be? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I even referred to, you know, universities have been going through this same kind of thing, trying to balance academia and, you know, financial realities. And guess what?
What?
He comes from having been the president of Haverford College.
And how does that cut? That puts him in...
So he is that kind of guy.
Okay.
Okay? He's been dealing with that balance already. And the fear is, apparently they're running about a $15 million deficit that they feel could balloon to as much as $40 million. But the thing is, the Louvre often... It runs a deficit, apparently, of like $8 to $10 million. So it's not unheard of. But the thing is how to accomplish it. He thinks it will be done mainly by cost cutting. But as I think you noticed, he also plans to really ramp up.
Right. He's going to rescue the museum by ramping up museum sales, particularly to men. In particular, cufflinks. Cufflinks are the future of the Metropolitan Museum.
No, he was just, that's just an example.
Okay.
But they say, but I mean, here's the thing. They said gift shops bring in about $7 per visitor right now. They'd like to triple that. That seems
Well, look,
ambitious.
I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's ambitious, but more to the point, you wonder why they have to do that. I mean, they have so many people visiting the museum. A lot of people are depositing a lot of money on the way in, even though there's some discretion.
And their admissions are up.
Right. So
and the Louvre is down.
Right.
And the British Museum is the Tate is down.
See, that's what I took from the article. What I took from the article was that they have challenges at the Met, and there are other museums with challenges, but those museums have attendance that's going down, and the Met Museum is going up, and they still have challenges. And that's what's curious about it.
Right.
Yeah, is the answer the gift shop? I kind of doubt it. But, you know, we'll see. It will play out.
And I should also mention, he has an undergraduate degree in art history.
Yeah.
He likes Byzantine art and Greek sculpture. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't?
Right.
And he has an MBA from Yale.
Okay.
So I feel we can relate.
That's good.
All right.
You can write him a letter.
Yeah. So there you have the
Look, I think he's obviously better equipped to handle this than the last guy who was the tapestry expert with no business experience, right? So that's clearly a step in the right direction for the Met.
Good luck, Daniel Weiss.
All right. So we've been watching a lot of college basketball. Matter of fact, we just turned off.
Was that what that was? Basketball?
That was basketball, yes. And so now we see the Final Four is set. You can read that in the newspapers. But they were pretty interesting games. But
very exciting games.
They were very exciting games. And, you know, one thing that we read during the week, I guess it was a journal, wondered why it is they're seeing so much in the way of zone defenses as opposed to man-to-man defenses, which was traditionally the way people played. And, in fact, it's what happened in the very last game. North Carolina was kind of letting that game slip away, and then with 5 minutes to go, they switched to a zone defense, and they scored basically 12 out of the last 14 points, and they won the game going away. And there is an answer to that question. It's kind of... twofold.
I mean, why it's mostly zone.
Why you have to play zone.
Okay.
And the reason, the obvious answer is because no one can cover anybody man-to-man. And the reason they can't is because the kids are so athletic offensively. And that's number one. But there's something related to that. And that is that the way the offenses are set up today, they're including the big men in the offensive flow.
The bigs.
The bigs. As you like to call them, the bigs, in the offensive flow. And that means that they're getting the ball far from the basket. Well, that's... interesting as far as it goes, but what it means for the defense, if you're playing a man-to-man, that means the defensive player for that big is far from the basket, and that's what you can't have as a defensive team. You can't have your bigs defensively far from the basket, and that's why you have to play the zone, and you're going to see more and more zone, and you saw it today.
Okay.
So you'll see it next week in the Final Four. That's
yes.
the answer to the question that the journal couldn't answer. But there was something else in the journal that I found even kind of more interesting, and it really goes to the power of the NCAA tournament. And I think we're going to see that this week, how it just makes stars out of people because it's such a big deal. And this week, I think you're going to see Frank Martin, the coach of South Carolina, become a star, a guy who's completely unknown. He's a very interesting personality. He's not a blue blood coach. And you look when you look at him, he looks like...
What do you mean by blue blood coats?
He's not a guy like Dean Smith. He's not a guy who, you know, coaches in kind of rarefied air. He's, you know, kind of a faux educator, kind of a venerated figure. He's not that at all.
Yeah.
He's a blue-collar, tough guy. He looks as if he's just as happy tearing you in half as answering your question. He's super intense. He's always wearing an off... color sports jacket.
Yeah, it was like burgundy.
Yeah, he looks like a bouncer, basically.
He was a bouncer.
Was he?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure one of his jobs.
I'm not surprised.
Part-time.
Well, you pointed out to me that his parents were
Cuban
refugees. Yeah. Cuban refugees. He's the first person in his family to be born in this country. He had a rougher road than a lot of these coaches, and he's a tough guy, but he's an interesting guy, and he's brought the South Carolina Gamecocks into the tournament. So we'll be reading about him. They're underdogs. But it's just the latest example. And the article in the journal is about Jalen Rose. And Jalen Rose was a member of the Fab Five, which was in 1990 or so. It was a bunch of freshmen who came on the scene and got an awful lot of publicity. They didn't win the championship. But the interesting thing about Jalen Rose is that as a result of him being a member of that team, everybody started naming their kid Jalen. Okay, what do I mean by that? And here's a quote from the article. Government data lends credence to the notion that the name essentially originated with Mr. Rose. There was only a handful of Jalens born before he became a public figure. Beginning in 1992 and 93, when Rose's Michigan team was one of the best in the country, the number of baby Jalens, according to the Social Security Administration, suddenly exploded.
Right.
That tells you how powerful the tournament is. And in the story, they ask about how it is that his mother gave the name Jalen. And it's the combination of two names. It's the combination of her brother's name, Leonard, and Jalen's father, James. And you combine them and you get Jalen. But what they don't tell you in the articles is who Jalen's father was. Who's James? James was Jimmy Walker. Jimmy Walker was one of the greatest college basketball players in history. He played for Providence. I saw him myself in Madison Square Garden as a college player score 50 points in the Eastern Championship Tournament. Phenomenal player. Went like number one in the draft, went to the pros, played on the Detroit Pistons with Dave Bing, another great player. Bing became so popular with the Pistons that after he retired, he became the mayor of Detroit. All right.
Wow.
Jimmy Walker, on the other hand, had issues. And after a few years of high-level play with Detroit, they traded him. And he bounced around the league a little bit. And it was during that period, during one road trip, that he fathered Jalen Rose.
Hmm.
So maybe not surprise you that he didn't really have a big role in the family or Jalen Rose's upbringing. But might surprise you is that Jimmy Walker never met Jalen Rose.
Wow.
And there was no question, that he was the father, what the paternity was. And Jalen Rose was asked about it as he became a famous basketball player with Michigan and later on in the pros. Could he approach his father? Which he didn't quite, honestly. And they said, do you want to meet your father? And he said, not particularly.
Huh.
And Dave Bing actually tried to bring the two of them together, but didn't succeed before Jimmy Walker passed away in 2007. So, interestingly, Jimmy Walker, probably the better player, is completely forgotten today. And Jalen Rose is on ESPN, and I think it's fair to say he made a pretty big name for himself.
Yeah, multiple names for himself.
Multiple names for himself, right.
Well, that's an interesting story and a little bit poignant. And I'm going to follow it up with just another art story.
Do your best.
Not as poignant.
Oh, no, I found this fascinating. This is the panel story?
Yeah, the panel story. But, you know... here's the deal. Here's the headline. How a museum curator solved a 600-year-old mystery.
Yeah, I think this is great stuff. I honestly do.
Well, I didn't really solve any mysteries so much. What you have is in North Carolina, the North Carolina Art Museum has a panel from an altarpiece done by the early Renaissance artist Francescuccio Ghisi, excuse my Italian. And the point is, there were originally nine panels, or there was originally a whole altarpiece that was divided up at some point into 9 panels. 8 still exist, 1's missing. And so in comes Daniel Steele, the curator at North Carolina, who wants to do an exhibition and wants to, witches he could find that missing panel. And he's done research over years and years and years trying to track it down. No such luck. The panels were, chopped up. At a certain point, the church, we don't even know what church it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, it was all chopped up and sold off to various collectors. And, various pieces are various museums now. So what they do, they don't find out what the missing panel was. Mm-hmm. They just make an educated decision that based on the narratives in the other panels, the other sections, that it could be this.
Right.
And they engage a conservator, Charlotte Caspers, who paints a panel in that style, in Giese's style.
Yeah, but isn't the problem is that it turns out that it didn't really look like the other panels?
Well, yeah. I mean, she does a great job. She does it using materials that would have been
right.
used by him
mm-hmm.
In the 14th century,
right.
1370, whatever. And she uses it according to techniques and procedures outlined by Cennino Cennini
right. Right.
in how to do this.
How else would you do it?
Right. So, nth degree. But when it's done, it's bright and
right.
shiny. It's got gilding on it. It's bright and shiny, and it doesn't look at all like the other 9 panels.
Right, but it doesn't look old. But what I found interesting about this
math comes in.
Exactly. Here we go.
And a mathematician at Duke, Ingrid Dobeschi, actually has formulated an algorithm
right.
that helps them approximate the crackleur, the crack patterns and fading of older works of art.
Mm-hmm.
This was done in the process of restoring the famous Ghent altarpiece by Jan van Eyck and Hubert van Eyck. And so that's applied here. And they're able to, using these algorithms, make the new panel look old, look
sure.
like the rest of them.
I think that's
so
right.
So in the exhibition, you have all the original panels,
right.
then you have pretty much a photograph
right.
of the new panel,
right.
the replacement panel, but looking old.
But here's what I thought was the best part when you explained it to me.
They can reverse the process.
That's the amazing thing. So there's a big market, obviously, for cleaning up or restoring older artworks.
Virtually.
Virtually. Now you can do it virtually.
Yes. Not literally
right.
Cleaning this altarpiece.
Right.
But being able to create an image that shows how it would have looked when it was brand spanking
new. I think that's fantastic, though, don't you?
And it's all because of algorithms.
It's all because of algorithms. Better life through science.
But it's not solving any 600-year-old mystery.
Well, no. All right. Well, then maybe
I think
headline's
that was,
off. All right.
That was quite the tease.
Well, I guess you're probably right. All right. So Chuck Berry passed away this week. And, everyone's had the opportunity to read about Chuck Berry this week.
But you found something.
Yeah, it's a little offbeat. It's a little bit different. And it turns out that Chuck Berry wrote a memoir. And it's pretty interesting because he wrote it in prison.
Mm-hmm.
He went to prison a few times. I think this was when he was in prison for tax evasion. According to the Times, it reads differently than other memoirs because it's not being interpolated by anybody. It's pretty graphic. It's pretty strong. And the early part, according to the Times, reads as if it had been scratched then in pencil onto a cell wall. I don't know what that means entirely, but what the Times points out is that it's a striking memoir, and it deals quite a bit with two subjects. The first is race. They say in his autobiography, race is nearly always front and center, and he talks about his experiences in the South. This is in the 50s and 60s. There are restaurants that wouldn't seat him, hotels where he could not book a room. He also writes how in St. Louis, where he was born, a mixed-race couple spotted by police would be hauled in for mandatory venereal disease shots. And there are other stories like that. Wow. So it's pretty rough. The other thing that's in the autobiography, according to the Times, is sex. As the Times puts it, he writes about sex with a wide-awake candor that's unusual and refreshing. Well, let me tell you what that means. According to the New York Post, who talked about the memoir also, their article is headlined, Chuck Berry was more than a rock icon. He was also a huge pervert. It's sort of a different angle on the same memoir. But what's funny about that is that whereas the Times, who says they're all for, you know, the transparency of Chuck Berry's memoir and his discussion of sex, they don't say anything about it. They can't write about it. Whereas the Post, who's supposedly very put off by this and disturbed by it, goes on at great length about the sex in Chuck Berry's memoir. And I don't really think, we're not going to explore whether you should read the memoir or not. I don't intend to read it, to be perfectly frank. And I think it's out of print on top of everything else. But I will say this about Chuck Berry. There is a great film I want to recommend, a great documentary about Chuck Berry's music and the music of people like Chuck Berry in the 50s and 60s called Let the Good Times Roll. That was released in 1973. And it's basically a concert reunion film. So think about this. It's a concert reunion involving folks like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Fats Domino, Chubby Checker, Bo Diddley, and the Shirelles.
Have you seen this?
Yes.
When did you see it?
Just before I started going out with you in 1973. In Long Island.
You can remember back that far?
It was a great movie. And right. 1973, but it's...
Let the good times
roll.
So the
film, it's in the style of Woodstock. For those who saw Woodstock, you'll remember a lot of split screen. What you have here, you have split screen where they're showing the reunion concert in 1971, 1972, but they're also at the same time showing film from the 50s and 60s when these guys were younger. And it is a fantastic film.
Okay.
So I don't know how you can get your hands on it, Netflix or Amazon or who knows. Let the Good Times Roll, released in 1973. See if you can get a copy of that.
All right.
And the next story is about baseball, which, you know, people like to talk about it being an old game going back to, you know, the early 1900s. Some people say some years before that. There's talk about the Civil War.
No.
It turns out that's
according
nothing.
According to the Wall Street
that's
Journal.
That's nothing. Okay. It will probably come from, as no surprise, according to the Journal, to baseball fans, that the ancient Egyptians placed their game on a par with life and sex. According to Professor Peter Piccioni at Charleston College, the term seker hemat, often translated as batting the ball, it began as a fertility ritual performed in spring festivals.
Right, and actually the article cites sacred wall paintings in Queen Hatshepsut's temple near Luxor, showing her stepson, King Thutmose III, ready to bat a ball at two priests. The inscription above Thutmose reads, "Striking the ball for the goddess Hathor."
Right.
And
which makes perfect sense, because if you've ever been in sort of a company softball game and you're batting, you know, you sort of look out. And if you see a priest playing second base, that's where you're going to hit the ball, because that's your best chance, really, of reaching base.
Well, it's amusing. We love Hatshepsut, of course, the first great
That's female pharaoh. I mean, I read this article.
This is like, but it's funny. I mean, you see these pictures on the side of her tomb, right? It's just like, you know, her Facebook wall. Really, yeah. And pictures of her stepson, who she didn't really get along with, you know, playing baseball. Well, it's just kind of cute.
But you were explaining to me, didn't get along with because you were explaining that.
Well, after she dies, he destroys all of her statuary and that's called damnatio memoriae. It's not uncommon for new rulers to destroy everything about the old ruler. But if you go to the Met.
Yeah.
And and there are quite a few statues of Hatshepsut. They're all reassembled. They all have been smashed to smithereens in their little pieces.
That's a little inside baseball.
But anyway, I do think it's fun that Egyptians invented baseball.
I mean, I see this article that baseball goes back to ancient Egypt. I'm looking, is it April 1st already? If I lost track of the date, but that's what they're reporting. it's mind-boggling.
Well, you got to admit, I think it's just a natural urge to just swing at a ball.
Right.
Right? Like, so, you know, it goes back.
Okay. All right. All right. So, so to close our show, we wanted to go back to...
When I don't get to talk about the dictionary?
Oh, yes. We missed that. Go ahead. Do the dictionary.
Well, I know everybody's interested in what books I want to read this week.
All right.
Week.
No, all right.
So
ahead.
There are a couple of interesting
ahead.
Things come up. One is... actually, by Corey Stamper, a lexicographer
right.
who works for Merriam-Webster.
Yeah.
So there's a fun article in the New York Times, actually during the week on Thursday, about her job and about her new book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries.
Right.
And it really is, you know, fairly interesting. The book gets a pretty good review as a it mixes... memoiristic meditations on the lexicographic, I don't even
close
know
enough, yes.
how to say that, lexicographic
the funny
life,
thing is,
along with a detailed description of the brain-twisting work of writing dictionaries.
The funny thing is you can pronounce the names of all the goddesses. That's what surprises me.
Well, I do that more often.
I guess so.
And I think about them more often than lexicography. It also got a review as an erudite and loving and occasionally profane history of the English language that is also a cheerful and thoughtful rebuke of the cult of the grammar scolds.
Yeah, okay. So
which
this
I sort of like.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
I've read some of those grammar scold books.
Yeah.
You know, and you do feel just kind of...
I still think it's
a
tough
sell. Are
being
a little too precious
yeah.
here?
Well, I tell you, one point they do make in the article, which is true when you think about it. You know, and a dictionary is not really the final word on proper uses. A dictionary is an attempt to capture how words are actually used.
Yes, I think that's a good point.
Right. So, for example, they use the word irregardless in here. And they say, well, you know, some people
really,
recoil
yeah, turn
from the word irregardless.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they say, no, we're not in the business of telling people not to say irregardless. They say it, so it's in the dictionary.
Right. And they also have a picture of the biggest, the fattest dictionary
right.
ever.
As a practical matter, you can't use.
Yes, you can't use it. Plus, you can't even, the technology to do that anymore
right.
doesn't even exist. So, and the other book I'm thinking about reading is by Domenico Starnone, or Starnone, depending on how you want to pronounce it,
yeah.
Who apparently is the husband of the woman they think is actually... writes under the name of Elena Ferrante.
Now, this goes back to something we mentioned last
the
week.
Stylometry.
Stylometry, which is able to identify who really wrote things. And the greatest mystery in Europe is who was Elena Ferrante, which is the pseudonym for this series of books.
Anita Raja
possibly.
Is supposed to be.
It is
but
raging debate.
They could taste it. They could test it.
And yet,
if
well,
they did the stylometry.
If any one of our listeners were to take a plane to Italy with a stylometrics handbook in their grasp, they would solve the problem in 10 minutes.
But anyway, it's a story of relationships, etc., in Naples, you know, kind of from a different perspective.
But you might really read the book, right?
I might really read the book.
Okay.
The it's translated by Jhumpa Lahiri.
Oh, yes. She's well known.
Yes. And she recently tried to write an Italian book. She does translations. And
No, but tell the story about that. Didn't she try to write a book in Italian?
Yeah.
Even though it's not her native language?
Right.
And how? But that wasn't that well received, was
No,
it?
But, I mean, it's an ambitious undertaking.
It's
Can
terribly
you imagine?
Ambitious.
Yeah. So right. so those sound interesting.
Yeah.
Domenico Starnone. And the book is called Ties.
All right.
So.
All right. So, sorry to cut you off, but now I guess we are looking toward the close of the show. But the close of the show, we just want to take you back to the New Yorkers for just a moment, because notwithstanding all the hilarity and the crazy jokes and the Jimmy Durante stuff and the nonsense that goes on for a couple of hours, they try to end on some kind of resonant note. And according to the Times, they succeed because it's not really about love or gangsters or prohibition. That's the Times says what the New Yorker celebrates above all are the hard-loving, hard-playing characters of its title. The cast closes the show with a goosebumps-raising rendition of I Happen to Like New York and establishing no doubt that what you're hearing is a city's sacred national anthem. And I Happen to Like New York is a song that became popular briefly after 9/11. I think there are some recordings you can pick up on YouTube. I think Donna Murphy did it, a few others. and people were singing because they were celebrating and saying about what happened in 9/11. And it does celebrate New York, but it was written in 1930 by Cole Porter. And people did react very strongly when they sang, "I Happen to Like New York." People stood up and cheered at the end of that show. And I'll just leave you with the very last verse of "I Happen to Like New York," which during most of the song, it talks about the various good things about New York and basically how rough New Jersey is by comparison. The last verse is as follows. "I happen to like New York. I happen to love this burg. And when I have to give the world my last farewell, and the undertaker comes to ring my funeral bell, don't want to go to heaven, don't want to go to hell, I happen to like New York."
And that's all for today. See you next week. Tamsin and Dan read the paper.